Okay, it's really two separate subjects. There was a talk here in August, I think, John Rule, was it John Rule? On Akbar, so, but probably half of you at least weren't here then, so so I'll go through it. It'll be fairly brief because we're not yet ready to discuss the power spectrum. We're hoping to do that in a month. We're hoping to do that in time that MAP can fold our result into their result. We operate at a different range of angular scales than MAP. Bill Holzapfel is the leader of the Akbar team. Akbar is a receiver that goes on the Viper telescope at the South Pole. John Rule helped with the cryogenics of that system. Our role at Carnegie Mellon was to build the telescope, which is called Viper. The detectors come from the Caltech, Jamie Bach and Andrew Lang group. And let's see, who do I want to point out here is especially talented? Marcus Runyon. These guys are going to be looking for jobs soon, so I want to point them out. Marcus Runyon, who's actually going to Chicago, did a lot of the design of the focal plane. And Shaolin Kuo has done the power spectrum analysis. And both those guys are just absolutely outstanding. And of course, we have to mention Matt Newcomb, who's just now finishing his second in a row winter rover at the South Pole. That's his third altogether and his second in a row. One of the goals, we want to measure the power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background and isotropy up to L of 2500. That's the damping tail part of the anisotropy power spectrum. And that measures a lot of the same parameters, if you want to think of it that way. But it measures them in a different way from the ways that they're measured in the acoustic peaks. And so it is, in a sense, an independent test of the paradigm and of the cosmological parameters. Since we have such a fine beam with Akbar, four to five arc minutes, we can see the Sinyaev-Zoldovich effect in distant galaxy clusters. And the instrument has a range of frequencies that allows us to be especially sensitive to the Sinyaev-Zoldovich effect and separated from the CMB. And that's a very useful thing, considering that we're now talking about lambda models, because galaxy clusters would have formed at around the time of cosmic inflection from deceleration to acceleration. There's a point in time when that switch happened, and that's about the time that galaxy clusters were forming, and so they end up being quite sensitive to that, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. Now, we can also look at nearby galaxy clusters, and you might think that's not quite as interesting, but you can't do this, use clusters as cosmological probes, unless you understand what clusters do, and we really don't understand what clusters do. There are very few Sinyaev-Zoldovich effect maps, images, large-scale maps of galaxy clusters. There are some with interferometry of the cores of galaxy clusters, quite a few, 50 to 100 now. No large-scale maps of nearby clusters for which you can get good X-ray and optical data, very few of those. We can do that, so we're doing that. Okay, so this is just a cartoon, which you've probably seen before, to talk about how structure formation is suppressed in the lambda universe in the late phases. So we now believe that the total density of the universe is 1 from cosmic background anisotropy first peak measurements, giving the first peak falls at L of 220. And so we believe that the curvature of the universe is flat, and that means the total density is critical, but that measurement doesn't tell us anything about the distribution among matter and dark energy. So if there is any quantity, I like to think of vacuum energy, and I know that's, you know, probably the cheap way to think of dark energy, but at least we know that the vacuum fluctuations are real. That's my experimentalist bias there, and I admit to the bias, but you know, liquid helium condenses at 4.2 Kelvin, dust sticks to my glasses, the Casimir force is measured, and The fine structure constant in high energy physics experiments does tend to grow at high energies. And all those are indications that vacuum fluctuations and polarization of the vacuum are real effects. And so, you know, I think of vacuum energy as real. And, you know, I don't know about quintessence and omega, and W less than minus one and things like that. And we're a long way from measuring W, so I'll just use vacuum energy if you don't mind. So. Anyway, if there is any vacuum energy density that's a constant as the universe expands, of course it does take over, right? Because there's just more and more vacuum all the time. So eventually it takes over, and so then we have lambda dominating, right? So this is a cartoon, that's not a calculation, just showing how lambda takes over. And here we are living in today's universe with 30% lambda, omega lambda, and 70% omega lambda, 30% omega lambda, right? It's all very familiar, I'm sure, to this crowd. So what happens to density perturbations in the universe at these two times? Here's the distant past, when omega matter was high. And so here's omega matter at 0.9. And so the average of this red curve, which is omega matter versus position, is 0.9. But I've got peaks that are supercritical. Little fluctuations, and these guys can turn around against the expansion of the universe and become objects. Okay? Now, that's the story at some high redshift, say 2. If we look at today's universe, the average matter density is now 0.3, pushed apart by vacuum energy. This little lump here ain't going to cross that line. Okay? No new large objects are now forming. And that happens in an open universe as well, of course, but it happens even more strongly in a lambda universe to some extent. Okay, so these are the galaxy clusters, and the idea is that they formed at some time in here, and so studying them allows you to see whether this is happening or not. Okay? Is that all reasonable? Okay. This is the Viper telescope, which we assembled at Carnegie Mellon. It's the clear aperture is 2.1 meters. We've extended it to 3 meters with incoherent extensions of the primary mirror. And that's at the South Pole. And this is it being lifted into place. It's inside a shield. This is a reflective baffle so that the sky, of course, is glowing at 250 Kelvin. And the ground is glowing at 250 Kelvin, and the sky is 10 Kelvin. So we'd rather see the sky than the ground, so we make a big mirror around the telescope so that any scattering within the telescope doesn't allow us to see the hot ground. And there it is being put into place. It is the largest telescope at the South Pole. It's one of the largest CMB telescopes around so far, and that means that we have high angular resolution. We can also use it at very high frequencies because it is at the South Pole.
Just because of size.
These wavelengths are a millimeter, so a few meters is what you need to get the angular resolution that we're looking for. This is the largest mirror that would fit in an LC-130. It just fits through the door. To go to any bigger telescope, you'll have to make segmented panels. And I didn't want to do that, so that's the size of Viper. Yeah, okay. I'll stand back here. This is the Akbar receiver on the telescope. This over here. All right. The focal plane array of Akbar has 16 elements in it. There are 16 bolometers all looking at the sky at the same time. It's cooled by helium-3 refrigerator here, made by Simon Chase. That's it on the cryostat. So, you know, it's cold already at the South Pole, 200 Kelvin in the winter. Then we have a nitrogen stage, liquid helium that's not pumped, liquid helium that is pumped, liquid helium-3 that's pumped, and another liquid helium-3 stage that's pumped to get down to 230 millikelvin. This isn't the South Pole record, by the way. We used to use adiabatic demagnetization refrigerators and set the record at 37 millikelvin. So that's the South Pole low temperature record. This is all automated, runs under LabVIEW. an enormous, put together in 18 months by John Rule and Bill Holzapfel. Wonderful, spectacular.
It's a homemade craft.
The tank was made by a cryofab, but all those parts on top were essentially homemade. This is it in the winter. We have to transfer liquid helium into it about every 3 days. It's a tank of liquid helium, and so this is the way the snow plasters up against the. This is 100 below zero when this is happening. So this is our hero, Matt Nuka. We use red light because there's an air shower experiment that's sensitive to blue light right next door. The original version of Akbar, the 2001 version, had four frequencies in it, these four frequencies. This one wasn't working very well for us. We got rid of it and added more of this frequency, which was working very well. There's a 150, 220, 275 gigahertz. Now these are fluctuations. This is the spectrum of fluctuations of the temperature of the anisotropy, positive and negative fluctuations. And the black curve is the spectrum of the Sinyaev-Zoldovich effect, the thermal Sinyaev-Zoldovich effect, which has a null at 220 gigahertz. So if I look at 220 gigahertz, I can't see clusters in their Sinyaev-Zoldovich effect. I get the pure CMB anisotropy at 220. And at 150, I get a decrement from a galaxy cluster, and at 275, I get an increment. So you can see that we've set up to separate these intentionally. We could get higher angular resolution at this frequency than that frequency. In this version of the instrument, we haven't tried to do that. We've tried to keep the beams about the same, just to make the data analysis easier. I think a next generation of this project would benefit from finer beams here, that's for the future.
What is the meaning for it? Is that one of your guys did it work? Or was it?
It's just too high in frequency, and the atmosphere is causing trouble for it. This dashed spectrum is the transparency of the atmosphere. You can see we're doing quite well at 150, 275, 150, 220, 275, but 345, this band, is the atmosphere is beginning to not.
Is it worse than you
expected? We had hoped to monitor the atmosphere with this band and subtract the noise from it from these bands. Turns out we don't need to. During the quiet periods, the noise is low enough in these bands that we don't need to subtract the atmosphere. So we made four more pixels of 150.
Was it a focal plane issue, Jeff, that you wanted to gain the focal plane back so you could put the other frequencies there? Or do you have problems in the
world? We're using all the focal plane that we can.
It's a real estate
issue. A 2-meter telescope has only, at these frequencies, a degree or so. This telescope has only got a degree or so of undistorted focal plane.
What's your F number on the telescope?
It's F, at the focal plane?
The primary
is at 1.5, F1.5. It's pretty fast. It is aplanatic. It's an aplanatic Gregorian. You can do a little better with other conic sections and other curves. But it's optimized, but it's not quite optimized. It's close. Okay, this is the recent CBI result and some others. They've double plotted here, the blue and green curves are two different binnings of the same data, so pick the set you color you like and pay attention to them, and the other ones are double plotting. My particle physicist friends call this cheating. The people who do it claim that if they explain it well, it's okay. Anyway, so this is the state of the art of power spectrum measurements at this high L range, and this is the damping of the structure in the cosmic background mostly due to photon diffusion as the compressed regions leak. You can change this damping tail by changing the baryon density. If I crank up the baryon density, photons have a harder time walking out of a dense region. They're random walking, back, bouncing back and forth to create the pressure. And they'll have to take more steps if the baryon density is higher. So This damping tail moves out if I increase the baryon density. So that's an example of how we are sensitive to cosmological parameters. There are other ways we're sensitive. One of the interesting ways is that this first acoustic peak has only compressed once in the time, in the first 300,000 years of the evolution of the universe. During most of that time, the universe was matter dominated. There's a transition from radiation domination to matter domination at redshift of, say, 10,000, something like that. The cosmic background's released at redshift of 1,000, 1,500. So these high peaks actually had some of their oscillations during the radiation dominated era. So it's possible, if you do a good enough job of measuring this, to determine the epoch of radiation domination, of matter domination. I'd be quite excited. Anyway.
What is the negative
power? Why does it have negative power?
Yeah.
It's appropriate to have negative error bars on such a plot, because they're
actually negative.
Oh, well, I don't know. Let's not worry about it. So anyway, here's what MAP and Planck can do. We're going to get the MAP announcement quite soon. They get the first three peaks exquisitely well, and then their beam size is too large to do much more. Planck is actually smaller than Viper, so we'll go actually a little bit farther than Planck. And we can point to individual objects and study them in detail. Planck will survey the whole sky. They won't get much time on any one cluster, for example. We can, even after Planck has flown, we could follow up on clusters and make a useful contribution. Here's data. This is an image of one of our CMB fields at 150 gigahertz. And so this is the first acoustic peak, those ripples there. That's the dominant feature, and that's it, right? This is it at 220 gigahertz. That's the RMS uncertainty. That's not the size of the power spectrum. That's our noise level on that field. This is not our best field. The CMB5 is, we've gone considerably deeper on CMB5.
That's the instrument.
That's the instrument noise, yeah, of this particular map.
But that's an object map by a single noise argument.
Yeah.
So your beam size on this is about the smallest of those?
Yeah, that's the beam size. Yeah. So here it is at 220 gigahertz. Let me go back and forth here a little bit. Okay, same thing? Everybody think that's the same thing? It's not quite registered perfectly, sorry. And our sensitivity isn't as good at 220 gigahertz.
Go back, I think there's a lot of features here.
Yeah.
Is that a cluster you have on the
lower left? I'll get to that.
Lower left.
Oh, lower left. You mean this?
Mid-left.
That
guy. Nah, down. Whatever.
No.
It disappeared at 220.
Oh, I see, I see. I see. Yeah, so you want to use...
I don't know your noise.
Yeah, probably not.
That's all right.
I would say probably not. Here's a simulation of how well we'll do. This is just up to our fifth field. We did seven, and our later fields were more organized. And so six and seven actually have more data in them than the rest. But our announcement will be just up to CMB field five. That's coming in a month or so. And the error bars on this plot are taken from our actual noise matrix. The values are taken from a model. Right? In other words, we're showing you what noise level we'll have, but we're not showing you the values we're getting.
Yeah. The errors are just noise.
The errors are...
systematics.
Including systematics, but not a calibration. There's no calibration error in this.
Why?
Yeah.
Is the large error at the peak?
That's the small size of our field. That's sample variance.
Why does it decrease again the next
point? You know, I don't even... Oh, yeah, it's proportional. It's sample variance, so it's proportional to signal size. Yeah. Right. Right. We could have tried to do better on sky coverage in order to reduce the sample variance. Where sample variance dominated basically from here down. But we know MAP is coming. They're going to do this very well. What we want to do is understand our systematics exquisitely well. And that means we want very deep observations. It wouldn't hurt the sensitivity much here to spread out our integration time. However, our ability to understand the systematics would be substantially damaged. So we found very tiny systematic effects. The reason it's taken us a while is that we've really been digging into the systematics, dividing the data set in half and comparing the halves, and we found some things which we had to deal with. So
your 13 microkelvins, is that on a smooth map or is that at the beam size resolution?
That's at the beam size per beam, yeah. As I say, we're doing a little better than that. Yeah. Well, you can see what the error bars are like here. Pretty good. Here's how we would compare to CBI. So this is, again, the simulation, our blue points. And now our frequency is 150 gigahertz, and so you know that in the CBI deep fields, they're reporting a statistically significant detection of an excess at high L here. It's quite exciting. It might be these galaxy clusters that I mentioned as an indicator of as probes in cosmology.
They're also saying that they needed a high value of sigma 8 to even explain that.
Yeah, about 1, yeah.
Yeah, which now there's this kind of split in the values of sigma 8 between a low value at 0.7 and a high value, and they were saying you need a high value to explain that.
Right, they were, yeah. So extrapolating to our frequency, they operate at 30, we operate at 150. The SC signal, if it is SC, would be reduced by 2. So their point, if we scale to our frequency, would land here, and this is what our sensitivity will be there. So. Perhaps we have a shot at seeing it, if it's real. This is an attempt to find clusters. I mentioned that we want to search for previously undetected galaxy clusters. So what we've done now, this is a field that happens to have a quasar in the middle of it. That helps us check our alignment, very important for controlling systematics. And so this is the quasar cut out of the middle. And then the map has been filtered with a Mexican hat filter. Mexican hat wavelet to pick out the objects that are sort of isolated from their neighbors. Clusters would appear as blue spots on this map, and this is now four microkelvin per 5 arc minute beam. Okay. And so the clusters are blue ones. Are there more blues than reds? Maybe. We certainly would have some things we'd like to follow up on, right? The most blue things we want to get telescope time to look at. You know, this guy. Maybe more blues than reds, a little hard to say. Certainly not a booming signal, but of course that's a result, right? If at 4 microkelvin we're not seeing clusters. Now that's.
Yeah, it would be surprising if 4 microkelvin.
Well, particularly if the CBI result is real, right?
Are you doing a difference in the maps?
This is not differencing the maps now. This is done for each map individually, differencing from regions around the area of interest.
This is coded in antenna temperature or thermodynamic?
Thermodynamic, yeah. Right. Okay, so that's where we sit. Here's our first pointed observation, then a known galaxy cluster. Redshift 0.05, quite a nearby cluster, Abel 3266. And now we can make two-dimensional maps of the field containing this cluster. And this is the decrement, the hole in the CMB. The white contours that you can't quite see are the X-ray emission from that cluster. And here at 220, we really don't see much. 275, we're now getting an increment on that cluster. We're doing much better than this now. This is our first one. We've done about 7 galaxy clusters. And then we can optimally combine these, considering their noise. They have different noise levels. And make a plot of the Y parameter. So this is a two-dimensional plot of the Y parameter alone. This is the first time that's been done.
What is the peak signal here?
250 microkelvin would be purple. So I'm looking at 200
something.
So. 200.
What size? If I read the numbers, what size now?
Okay, let's see. These are arc minutes. That's 30. That's 15 arc minutes right there. 15 arc minutes. So 25 arc minutes square.
And how long do you need?
This is a long time. It's several days. Yeah. Yeah. We're now, we've switched to observing just clusters now. The sun has come up, and we don't quite trust the results for CMB. A little bit of diffraction of the sun peeking over the shield would affect the large scales particularly. But we can still do these somewhat more focused images of galaxy clusters. So we're concentrating our time now. A station just opened, and we're going to run as long as we can, until December maybe, looking just at clusters.
What's your pointing accuracy like?
1 arc minute. Yeah, it's about 1 arc minute. Most of our fields have a quasar, intentionally. So we get a lot of data about the quality of our point. But we really know the point quite well. One thing is that a mechanical moving mirror in the telescope is scanning the beam across the sky. And so the beam shape does change a little bit with position. And that was the systematic error that slowed us down. We didn't understand that well enough.
It changed by how much?
Small enough. It's just, it's...
The 10%, 2%.
Less than 10%. But if we have pointings of the same field where we've offset slightly. If you naively just subtract those from each other and don't take into account that 10% variation of the beam size, you get a residual in the result, which led us to find that.
So how far are you throwing?
3 degrees.
3 degrees. Yeah. Why are you
throwing
so far?
Oh, when we do the clusters, we're not. But when we do the CMB fields to get the first peak, what?
The clusters have already.
Probably about 3 times this, 1.5 degrees, something like that. And this is Akbar and Jeff. Okay, well, so I've got some time left, so I want to talk about something that's completely new. Let me just ask if there are more questions about that.
What was your effective noise on the
sky? Around 200 microkelvin root seconds.
CMB.
Yeah. That's at 150. It's worse. Is it in one of these? Was it in there?
I didn't see it.
Oh, well.
Is that the aggregate for all the 150?
Per pixel.
Per 150.
Per pixel. Yeah, it's very sensitive. Yeah, it's comparable to some of the balloon experiments. They're getting better now, the balloon experiments, but well, it's comparable.
When do the results come out?
We're hoping in 1 month. We want to get the results and the correlation matrix out and let people fold that in with MAP. And hopefully the MAP team will do it for us. It does give them some leverage that they can't get as well with other data. Leverage in L. Yeah. Okay, so it's a theoretical audience, and this is a kind of an experimental topic, but I just want to say a few words about it because I'm having a lot of fun with this. We've started to make the world's tiniest bolometers using nanotechnology. And this has the potential to make possible a new class of detectors that actually counts individual CMB photons. Now, you don't actually need to count individual CMB photons, but there are other applications in astronomy where this technology would be particularly valuable. Actually, the application that comes to mind is the scuba sources. You know, in the scuba map, there are these half dozen submillimeter bright sources. Nobody knows what they are. They might be galaxies. They might be AGN, and surely there'll be some of both as we study these sources. By studying the continuum emission, you're probably not going to be able to tell them apart for a long time. What you want to do is look at the lines. You want to look at the broadened lines from the central region of an AGN as an indicator of an AGN, and also the high ionization states. And you want to do that in the submillimeter where the radiation can actually get out. So that requires very narrow frequency resolution, and the number of photons are few, and this technology would be very good for that from space.
What is current efficiency, at least for CMB?
Well, the current efficiency?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that what you're trying to just...
In 1 second, in the Akbar, there are 10 to the 12 photons. And we typically sample 1,000 times a second, okay? So square root of 10 to the 9 is the number of photons, package size of number of photons you actually need to count to do the CMB job. So we're talking some four orders of magnitude more sensitive than that, potentially. It just is, it does have the potential to count millimeter wave photons, even though the CMB is not probably the best application for that.
See, for novices in this field, could you remind us what the traditional bolometer is?
I will.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the brightness of the sky. This plot shows the brightness of the sky. Here's the CMB peak. We're all familiar with the CMB peak, right? And it dominates the landscape. These are, tick marks are 100 each, right, in intensity. There are two orders of magnitude per tick. So so that's all the energy in the universe, of course. We already knew that. It's interesting to note here that all these interfering sources like radio sources and infrared sources, if you bring these down to cross here, it's got quite a bit of room from the peak. And also these have spectral signatures and spatial signatures. And so you really could imagine going to maybe 10 to the minus 8 of that peak in some experiment someday. You know? So people who want to find B modes have courage. It might just actually be possible. Now, the main point I want to make is that basically this is a cosmic background Planck function with a few hangers on, and that means that in this region of the spectrum, the photon occupation number is greater than 1 of the sky, and in this region of the spectrum, the photon occupation number is less than 1. The photon occupation number, if I had a waveguide and I sent the photons down a waveguide, it'd be the number of photons in every wavelength in the waveguide. Yep. Okay? You use different techniques in these two regimes. This is the receiver regime, where the photon occupation number is large, and this is the photon counting regime, where the photon occupation number is low. However, there is no technology that can count the photons beyond about 100 microns wavelength. You need to liberate a charge, typically. You know, photomultiplier tube, photon comes in, knocks off an electron, needs the work function to do that job, right? So a finite energy is needed, and there isn't any known technology to close this gap. Maybe we
use superconductivity with Cooper curves.
That's what we're doing. Yeah. So what's a bolometer? A bolometer is a device that that measures the power coming in thermally. So here are CMB photons and a filter to pick out a range of wavelengths. I absorb all that power. The heat energy goes down some link to a cold reservoir, and that device warms up slightly. It's colder than the cosmic background. It has to be colder than the cosmic background because the phonons that travel up and down this link have Bose statistics, and the photons have Bose statistics, and these are 3 Kelvin photons, and we want their noise to dominate over this noise, so that temperature's got to be less than that temperature. Yeah. 0.3 Kelvin is typically this temperature, and that's what we use in Akbar. Let me just go back. So this is kind of a problem. You have to have this cold reservoir in order to make a bolometer work well. You're forced into advanced cryogenics if you want to use this technology. Because it's thermal by nature, it's going to have, it's affected by its temperature. Not true for an amplifier, receivers. An amplifier can ignore its own thermal noise. And I just want to give you one quick example of a way an amplifier ignores its own thermal noise. This is a parametric amplifier. And people make these. It's not the best technology, but it's easy to see how it ignores thermal noise. So I take two mirrors, and I send a wave bouncing between those two mirrors. And then I move this mirror back and forth at twice the frequency I'm interested in amplifying. And the valleys of the wave get amplified by a push, and the peaks of the waves get amplified by a push, and the wave gets bigger and bigger as it bounces back and forth. Okay? So send in a small wave, a big wave comes out. Now, these can be perfectly reflecting mirrors. It doesn't matter what their temperature is. It ignores its own temperature. So that's an advantage of an amplifier technique as opposed to measuring the total power. They will, yeah. That will average out to the point that it doesn't matter.
It's not that it's without noise, it's just lower
noise. It can have a lower effective noise temperature than its physical temperature. I can buy an amplifier for my satellite TV dish that I have in the backyard that sits there at 300 Kelvin and adds only 20 Kelvin noise to the radiation stream coming in, and that's $100 for that amplifier.
That's presumably because of some bandwidth selection, which I guess is what you're dealing with.
You're going to select the bandwidth, yeah. Well, the problem with this idea, with an amplifier, is that there will be zero-point fluctuations of the electromagnetic field in this cavity. And those get amplified too. Even if I send in no real photons at all, I get energy out of the pump, and I make photons coming out here. So it has a dark noise associated with it. And that gives it an effective noise temperature that's quantum mechanical in nature, of h nu over k. Okay. So where you have lots of photons coming in, that's okay. On the low side of the spectrum. And that's why receivers are used at low frequencies. But you don't want to use a receiver at a high frequency, you get extra noise. Yeah? Okay. Bolometers, you asked about types of bolometers. We used to make them by hand. You know, professor makes one, the graduate student makes one, you compare them, whichever's best you use. Make them under the microscope with little wires and solder. That's only 10 years ago. That was the way to do it. This is one that's made by microlithography now. So there's a silicon wafer here, a sheet of silicon nitride on top of the silicon wafer, and then the silicon nitride silicon's been cut out over this whole area, and the silicon nitride's been cut out over that area, and the part that heats up is just this little piece in the middle. That reduces the thermal mass, makes it faster and more sensitive. This is the spiderweb bolometer that we have in Akbar. Here's an array of those. This is a JPL array and a German array. SCUBA will have an array, SCUBA 2. Of 2,000, over 2,000 bolometers. Quite impressive. And that's another picture of this.
So the actual sensor is the thermistor, which changes heat into resistance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you're looking
at. Yeah. This is a piece of germanium that's been doped to be almost conducting, almost at the metal insulator transition, still on the insulator side. It's a semiconductor. But it's a very highly conducting semiconductor, and even at 0.1 Kelvin, it still has some conductivity, although it's going away, and that makes the thermometer. The wave is absorbed here by a grid in order to reduce the thermal mass of this and make it faster. Instead of having an area absorber like the first one I showed, but this one's got an area absorber all coated with bismuth to absorb the wave. This one, that's been replaced by a grid of very fine wires that are resistive in order to reduce the thermal mass.
So it's those wires that are actually absorbing the radiation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then this has all got to come to thermal equilibrium. Some heat leaks out these spider web legs. That's where the heat does leak out. And there is some gradient of temperature across it. But there are many more links here than there are links out. So this is almost isothermal. And the thermometer measures its temperature.
How do you read it out?
You flow a little current through the sensor in the center and measure the voltage.
So just treat it.
Yeah, there are wires laid down on some of these spiderweb threads. That's absolutely spectacular. I mean, this is This is 5,000 angstroms thick and 10 microns wide. There's nothing to these things. They're quite amazing. However, you don't need to go to all this trouble.
And the thermistor is thermally grounded somewhere?
Well, it's its own electrical power plus the optical power arriving heats this all. And the heat comes out these legs, and this is held at the low temperature.
Oh, the heat goes back out.
Right, right. This is a silicon wafer out here, and you can connect that to the thermal ground. Now, this, the size of this object, by the way, is the wavelength that you're interested in. You want to absorb the wavelength of that wave efficiently, and so you, at first, you might think you need an absorber of the size of the wavelength. But you don't. You can use an antenna. So here's a little dipole antenna. That's actually is bigger than the photograph here, but let's say it cuts off here. And if I make send in a wave that's a half wavelength fitting here, yeah, then that's a nice dipole antenna like you all played with in Jackson. If I put a resistor in the middle that terminates that antenna, all the power is absorbed here in that resistor. Now, how small can the resistor be? Well, Maxwell's equations set no limit on how small that resistor will be. Solid-state physics might set a limit, but there's no limit for Maxwell's equations. You know, you listen to your AM radio in your car, it's a 100-meter wave, and there's a 1-micron gate on the transistor in your radio. So we can take a bow-tie antenna like that. We can send the wave out of the bow-tie antenna, absorb it outside, off the device if we want. This can be the isolated panel now with a thermistor. This one has a superconducting transition edge to measure the temperature. I'm going to go through this, I'm basically skip this part here. We made measurements of such devices, and they do absorb all the power. This would be 90% efficiency. Below here is 90% efficiency. This is return loss, what's not absorbed. And at the best, 99% is absorbed at the best frequency. Very wide bandwidth. This is a very
this
large.
Is a room temperature resistor, you couldn't wait that, just working it.
But lithographed. Right. Okay, so that led us to think of a new idea. This question, how small can we make this resistor? Well, what's the smallest resistor we could possibly make? So we started with a nanotube. So I showed a picture on the first slide of a nanotube, which is just a rolled up layer of atoms. And they're, the 10 atoms are.
Why do we want to make it geometrically smaller?
Well, so that the heat is concentrated in a small volume so that you get a large temperature rise. It makes it more sensitive. Yeah. So on our bow tie, let's put a nanotube in the middle. Got to get the current to flow through the nanotube. A few technicalities. That can be a conducting nanotube. It could be an insulating nanotube with a little bit of metal laid on it. And the heat is all dissipated here. This basically, even at optical frequencies, is a DC device. It's just a lumped constant circuit element, even at light wavelengths. This is only 100 nanometers long. It's shorter than the wavelength of light. So the heat is very, very strongly concentrated. That makes it extremely fast, too. A side benefit that might be important. What you can work out what conductivity you want. So say I make this nanowire. If I choose the conductivity to be too low, thermal conductivity, it'll overheat in the middle. And now I've got a hot device in the middle, and it makes noise, makes thermal noise. If I choose it to be too low, then it never warms in the middle, and I don't have good sensitivity.
I think it's going to back up. I mean, obviously, it's not just absorbing the radiation. You have to read out what you've absorbed, and so when you go there, it affects you.
You're going to use a comparable electrical power. The electrical and optical powers will be about the same. Could be less, yeah. But it will take the pressure off the amplifier following to increase that power. If I flow more current through the device, I get a larger response. Makes the amplifier easier to make, and it doesn't cost me anything. So in reality, they're always operated with the electrical and optical power about the same.
You operate this as a thermistor in the sense that as you're heating it up, its resistance is changing.
Yeah.
Using some other technique.
Yeah. The device is also the thermistor. Superconducting close to the transition edge. But then it's going to respond to photons in the end. Okay. This is the thermal conductivity we want. Basically, this square here, we need to be at 0.3 Kelvin. We need a certain thermal conductivity, so it'll warm a little bit in response to the CMB, but not too much. This is the area we need, and so we can figure out what material we need. This is a plot from a solid-state book or cryogenics technology book. Pure metals are no good. They're too conductive. The insulators are okay as a substrate, graphite, pyrex. That's okay. They're not in the picture. What is good? Alloys. Copper, nickel, manganese, stainless steel, brass. Also superconductors. Here's zinc that would come through the box, right?
So it wasn't your
question,
how you chosen your sweet spot.
Well, the temperature is chosen by being colder than the cosmic background.
Right. I can understand you might want to choose the temperature convenient to get to 0.3 Kelvin.
Well, it's got to be colder than the CMB if we want to do CMB work. Now, if you want to do submillimeter work, you might settle for 1 Kelvin. Yeah.
But okay, so that drives your temperature as a practical consideration. But no, I'm still puzzled as to how you're choosing your conductivity point.
Yeah. Yeah. Single mode CMB power is 10 picowatts. Okay. If I had a conductivity where 10 picowatts would produce a 10 Kelvin temperature rise, I would have too low conductivity, right? That's the bottom of this box.
So you chose it to be 10 Kelvin at the bottom, and then...
I want a substantial response to make the device sensitive, so the top is close to the bottom. Right? I want it to warm up a little bit in response to CMB power, some fraction of its own temperature. So CMB power raises the temperature here at the center of the box by that value, by its own size, roughly. Okay.
Well, I got lost on some what we're attracted to. When you talk about individual photons, you're not going to count photon by photon, are you?
Well, this device has the potential to count photons individually.
I have to explain, I come from the dark matter detection community with respect to these things. And of course, there it's like a particle detector. We detect each event, we go.
Yeah.
But here you're just talking about continuous heating so far.
That's right.
So it's not
I've not gotten to photons yet at all.
You have not. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're going to concentrate the heat in this nanotube?
Yeah.
It's going to get hot, and then what's going to be the signal you read out? The conductivity of the tube will change with the temperature.
Yeah.
Because it's...
Which will read electrically with additional contacts.
How quickly does it cool?
Probably 30 picoseconds.
So that's
calculated. No one has measured that.
So there's some wires attached to this black line which are measuring its resistance.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's see. Correct me offline too, Jeff. If you're using a TES, there's a coherence length in the superconductor. It's probably larger than the diameter of the tube.
Probably.
No, but this is not a superconductor tube.
Well,
we put superconductor on. We've done experiments where we put superconductors on these tubes. We use an insulating tube and put a superconductor on the tube.
Oh, it's not a carbon nanotube.
It's fluorinated carbon, the one that's insulating. So it's doped to be insulated.
And that stuff is also superconducting.
Then we add a superconducting layer.
Oh.
Use it as a scaffold to support a superconducting layer. But you guys are so far ahead of me.
What?
You're ahead of me. Okay. Well, I found that people were making these things, nanowires, with superconductor on them. So we've been working with Alexei Bezryadin at Illinois. And he makes these beautiful nanowires on top of a nanotube. So this is an insulating nanotube. And the highest lithography technology he can get makes this gap in silicon nitride And then underneath there's a silicon dioxide layer, so you put this in hydrofluoric acid and it eats out a little cavity underneath here. And then he sprinkles nanotubes on the top. You can buy nanotubes by the gram. It's about $100 a gram for carbon nanotubes. And you just sprinkle some on top, and some of them cross the boundary, and then you evaporate. You've got to find them later. It's a lot of work to this. This is just, this project's in its infancy, right? This is not a detector you're going to make 10,000 of at this point.
Are we talking microns here, or how big is this?
This is one-tenth of a micron, 100 nanometers. The wire is 10 nanometers. 100 atoms wide. It's less than that, actually. 70 atoms wide. This is 70 atoms wide. There's only about 10 million atoms in the whole thing.
Well, then he's got a point. If you won't act like a classic superconductor.
Yeah,
it's like it's really huge.
Well, I think that's probably true. That's an image of one. That's not imaging, it's just you get a reflection from electrons where the wire is. It's much smaller than can be resolved with the...
Oh, this white strip is the wire?
Yeah, that's the wire. That's a nanowire across the gap. So here are some measurements of these devices. So, molybdenum germanium has a transition temperature of 8 Kelvin in the bulk. The contact regions are a thin film outside the nanowire. They have this transition temperature, 6 Kelvin. So this is the resistance versus temperature measured with very small currents. And the resistance falls, that's the contacts going superconducting. This is the wire going superconducting. Superconductivity is suppressed in the wire. You know, the Cooper pairs require a lattice distortion to exist. So we put an electron in a lattice, the lattice distorts. Another electron can pair with that electron in the lattice distortion. Right? This is only 70 atoms wide. What do you mean by a lattice distortion, right? It's really a one-dimensional lattice distortion. So this is now one-dimensional superconductivity. Well, I'm not quite to photon counting. I probably should get there fairly quickly, but... At temperatures above this transition temperature, 4 Kelvin, it's just a slightly nonlinear resistor. But down here, it's hysteretic and very, very nonlinear. So the red curve is at 1.6 Kelvin right here. And so there's an offset to the voltage here that's just instrumental. That's not real. That line should really be on zero. Anyway, I start increasing the current in this superconducting wire. And the current goes up and up with no voltage. Superconducting. I get to the critical current where the lattice distortion is now moving at the speed of sound, basically. Okay? Beyond that, it can't keep up with the electrons, and superconductivity breaks down. It jumps up to a normal state. Now it's dissipating power. It's got a voltage and a current that heats up in the middle electrically. And now, when I turn the current back down again, the voltage back down again, doesn't go normal right away. It waits to here to come back down. So this is very nonlinear. And from the size of this hysteresis curve, you can determine the thermal conductivity of the wire. And basically, this is proof that this is an active detector that's going to work. I can bias it here, put optical power into it, and I will see the change of its resistance with optical power. And you can get what the sensitivity is going to be from this curve. It also turns out to have exactly the thermal conductivity we wanted, 10 to the minus 10.
This looks a lot like the behavior of a squid in
Joseph. It does. But that curve is actually flipped from this one. There's the IV curve is rotated.
So if I want to understand vaguely what's going on, it's something like putting...
Well, I don't know how important tunneling is in these devices. Phil mentioned that the coherence length is larger than our device.
Yeah,
So tunneling is very likely important from one side to the other. And that's something I haven't figured out yet, the role of tunneling. The other thing we know is that if we don't very carefully shield the radio stations outside the experiment. If we leave our experiment open at all, we don't get this curve. And that means that it is sensitive. It's working as a barometer. This is thermal conductivity as a function of temperature. We got the right value. Here's 10 to the minus 10. That's what we want. It's working. Here's a little bit of, so now let's get to photon counting. And then I'll quit. This is much more technical detail than most of you want, I know. Here's what happens when you put a voltage across a one-dimensional superconductor. What happens is the Cooper pairs accelerate, and they have a lot of mass because there's this large lattice distortion associated with the Cooper pair. So Cooper pairs really have a lot of mass. And so there's what's called the London inductance. If I start a current at this point in time, the voltage will rise. Wait a minute. I start the voltage across the device. This is at a constant voltage. The current will rise, excuse me, LdIdt. Okay, so the current rises, and that's all supercurrent. Then it reaches the critical current, the supercurrent. And what happens is the superconductivity is disrupted, and there's a pulse of normal current. The supercurrent gets reset to zero, and it's a relaxation oscillator. I can bias the device with a current just under here. The phase slips occur in the order parameter at this point, and I can stimulate the phase slips with photons, basically. We haven't proven that we can do that, but we're convinced it will work. And the size of these photons that allow the phase slips to be stimulated and pulses to come out of the device of voltage are smaller than the Cooper pair binding energy, because you're right up here with the Cooper pairs ready to break up anyway. So we believe we can close the gap in that first plot of mine of photon counting not going down to the receiver regime. We have not proven that. You know, we've just done a very few experiments. We've never even put microwave radiation on one of these detectors yet. So this is just in its infancy, but it's intriguing. Eventually, we'll lithograph them. We have a ion beam machine that can make a very fine wire by milling away some material. So that would allow us to make large arrays without having to make little nanotube scaffolds. A lot of open questions. This relaxation oscillation picture with phase slips, which I didn't really explain. I've talked too long already. We have to check that really is happening in our devices. Is tunneling important? I mentioned that. We've never absorbed millimeter wave radiation on these detectors. We believe we can do that. It works in the room temperature models. This is basically doing a Josephson oscillation if you bias it with enough of a voltage. Can that make a local oscillator for terahertz frequencies? If you can stimulate these pulses, phase slip pulses, and they make radiation, maybe you can make an oscillator out of this, a maser. Yeah? I'm kind of doubtful of that. We haven't measured what its real response is or its noise. Should be extremely fast, 30 picoseconds. So that means it would be a mixer as well as a detector. And we can directly look for the Josephson oscillation. So we have tons to do in the lab with these. And we're just getting started. But we do have the right thermal conductivity, so we think we sort of understand what we're doing so far. Okay.